California's new state schools superintendent was sworn in this week. We'll speak with Tony Thurmond about the top issues facing our schools and hear his vision for education in the state. Cap Radio's theater and music critic Jeff Hudson will preview several of the top classical music and jazz concerts headed to the area in the coming days and weeks. And on the topic of classical performances, we'll meet a child musical prodigy. 10-year-old Amran Olmeda plays the violin and will be the guest soloist with the Auburn Symphony later this month. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruryak. That's today on Insight. First, here's the news. From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruryak today. In less than 2 hours, California Governor Gavin Newsom is set to release his vision for the state budget, which is expected to include major spending for early childhood education. But how will the governor address struggling school districts that face massive budget deficits? Sacramento City Unified, for example, is estimated to be in the red $30 million or more, with some saying a state takeover is possible. Joining us by phone today is the newly sworn-in Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tony Thurmond, to help us understand the top issues facing education in the state. And welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Yeah, Superintendent Thurmond, by many measures, California's economy is doing very well right now. So why are some districts like Sac City facing such tough times financially?
You know, even though the economy has been, you know, strong and districts have had more overall funding through the local control funding measure that's been put in place in the last few years, the truth of the matter is that California funding lags most states. We're somewhere in the mid-40s in per pupil spending. Compared to other states. And for those reasons, most of our districts are just struggling to keep up with the rising costs of education. And we need to identify some permanent funding measures that will help the state. And that's something that I'm committed to working on during my tenure.
So with Governor Newsom getting ready to release his budget proposal, which, of course, is just the first step in a long process to get an actual budget, what do you hope to see as part of this initial discussion when it comes to funding?
Well, I'm really encouraged by the statements that the governor has been making since this campaign about making major investments in early education. We know that, putting more money into preschool and quality child care means that our students will graduate and go on to post-secondary education. It also means that we'll be spending less in terms of trying to counter the achievement gap and for kids who don't learn to read by third grade. I believe that the governor understands that districts need help. And, you know, I'm hopeful that there will be, some money that will help districts keep up with some of the rising costs of education. I'm hopeful that there'll be dollars to help the communities that have been impacted by wildfire. We're finding that now part of the way that we help school districts is to recover from disasters, replacing facilities and helping schools rebuild. Literally after there's been, tragic events. And so we're hopeful to see a vigorous conversation about how we invest more in our schools and in programs that help prepare our kids for the jobs of the future.
Have you had a chance to have a conversation with Governor Newsom yet when it comes to funding?
We have. I mean, we've talked in general about working closely together in education, and the governor has been very, very open about wanting to have a strong partnership between his administration and ours at the California Department of Education. Quite frankly, it's not always been that way, and I'm really encouraged that he sees us as a partner. I've known the governor for many years, from his days back to local government and mine as well, and I appreciate having a governor who campaigned on talking about big ideas that we can implement to improve early education and K-12 education and higher education. I am hopeful. I know that there are great expectations. I know that we've got to be mindful that the economy may change, but I think that we've got the right governor at the right time who will be an education governor, and I'm looking forward to working closely with him.
Superintendent Thurmond, you mentioned the local control funding formula. Your predecessor, Tom Torlakson, was a supporter of that. It sounds like you are as well.
I am. You know, I've been, you know, I was on a school board in 2008 when the economy was at its worst, and that meant that programs were cut and teachers laid off, and that had a direct and negative impact on the classroom. The local control funding formula has really allowed school districts to rebuild much of what was cut and to restore programs, to restore staffing levels. And so I do support it. It's given us some resources to help students who need even more help, students who are in foster care, English learners, kids who are on free and reduced lunch program. You know, it really has given us a boost, but it's a start and a step. And by itself, it will not address the needs of California's education. Listen, I think our kids are number one. And with California being the fifth wealthiest economy in the world, there's no reason for us to be in the mid-40s on what we spend on our students. I think we've got to get it back to number one again. And I'm committed to working with the governor to identify some permanent funding sources that will allow us to bolster California's education and make sure that our students are going to be the scientists and working in technology, engineering, arts, and math, and even for those who want to work more in career technical education and maybe an apprenticeship training program, that we're providing those opportunities for our students going forward.
Do you see any downsides to using the local control funding formula?
I don't see any downsides. I just think the only caution that I would offer is that it really doesn't cover the needs for where we need to be. And if you, if anyone has read, a number of reports have been published recently, one of them in particular called Getting Down to Facts Part 2. This is a research effort that compares California to other states. And it says that we are woefully below what we should be spending for our students. And in part, it's because of the way our funding structure is set up. We are very dependent on sales tax and property tax, and when taxes fluctuate, and income tax. And when those taxes fluctuate because of a downturn in the economy, we find ourselves susceptible and making more cuts. And so I would say that we are at sort of the baseline level of funding that we need to be. We're not at the level of funding that we need to be to really help close the teacher shortage and improve special education programs and prepare all of our students for the jobs of tomorrow. And so local control funding formula gives us a place to start. We've got to build on that so that we are really creating a 21st century education for all of our 6 million students.
So local control doesn't use the per pupil metric for funding, but using the state's current metric, where we are now and where you'd like to be, what's the difference in that gap?
I'd like to see us, you know, right now, we're, you know, by most estimates, California ranks 45th or 46th in comparison to all states in what we spend on our students and on public education. Obviously, I'd like to see us get to number one. I think that will take some time. I think it's possible for us to be somewhere closer to the top 10 in the next 4 to 8 years, and I'd like to have 8 years to help work on that. You know, we have some opportunities to rectify lost revenue that comes through how our property taxes for corporations are provided to the state. There's going to be a ballot measure in 2020 as proposed that could generate another $11 billion in permanent revenue for the state, almost $6 billion for K-12 education. And I should say for your listeners, if that measure were to pass, it would not increase taxes for homeowners or for seniors or for small businesses, but it would close a loophole that's allowed large corporations to pay very small amounts of property tax to the state.
Is that money guaranteed even if we enter a recession in the next couple of years?
Well, it would be the tax rate would be guaranteed. And so, you know, it would basically change the formula for how corporations pay property tax. And that is, of course, based on the value of the property. And so it's a guarantee, but the amount could change based on the valuation of property. And so we know that in a downturn, Sometimes our homes or our businesses, the value, property values may dip. In any case, that would be a permanent source of revenue that we could count on to support the 6 million students in our state.
Among your stated priorities is a plan to address the state's teacher shortage. How do you plan to accomplish something like that?
Well, as we're seeing across the country, as teachers have spoken out about working conditions, this is a challenge all across the country. Certainly, we are impacted in California. The number one issue, according to the research that I've seen, that impacts our teacher shortage is working conditions. And anyone can put themselves in the position of where you're in a job that has a lot of demands, typically very low salary, high class, high class levels. And so if we can work on improving working conditions to support what is really a great profession, our teachers do great things for our kids, and we've got to really double down and invest in that. And, you know, in my past as a legislator, I've introduced legislation to provide scholarships for anyone who wants to become a teacher, to provide a lot of professional development and training, and to help provide benefits for our teachers. You know, one of the big issues that our teachers in our state experience, like most Californians, is the high cost of housing.
Right.
There are many districts that we find teachers and staff simply can't afford to live in the communities where they work. And I've introduced legislation that I intend to work on again that would create a teacher housing program so that we can build affordable housing for our educators and for other educators who are interested, help them acquire their first home or pay down some of their loan debt. We've got to provide these kinds of incentives that will help us to build up our teacher corps and then provide them with world-class training to make sure they're preparing our kids for the 21st century.
We are speaking with the newly sworn-in California State Schools Superintendent about his vision for public education in California. And Superintendent, you are a product of public education. That was a part of your campaign. You've said you could easily have ended up in prison, but instead you're overseeing the state's 6.2 million students and more than 10,000 schools. How did public education make that difference for you?
I'm grateful for my education. I'm grateful for my teachers. My mom was an immigrant. My mom came to California from Panama, and she was a teacher. My dad was a soldier. He served in Vietnam and experienced a lot of trauma, and my dad didn't return home to our family. I actually found my dad on the internet as an adult when I was in my late 30s. And so my mom raised four kids by herself, and when she got very sick, my mom had cancer. She lost her battle to cancer when I was 6 years old, and I got sent off to live with a cousin who I never met until I showed up in a low-income household where we depended on food stamps and the free lunch program and a lot of public programs. And the greatest public program that I ever experienced was getting a great education. And my teachers invested in me. And in spite of, humble beginnings, in spite of moving around and how easy it would have been for me to fall through the cracks, I didn't. Because my teachers really invested in me and let me know that my life would be different than it started. And that education carried me to a chance to get a college education and a 20-year career helping other young people as a social worker, and to be an elected office for the last 12 years and to now have the greatest job anywhere elected to support 6 million students in the state. I want all kids to have those kinds of opportunities as I did. Education literally saved my life, and I just think if we double down and invest in education, we can support our students in this state.
You have two daughters of your own. Are they in public schools?
They are. They are.
And one of the priorities you've outlined is to reduce the achievement gap. What are your plans for addressing the disparity among different groups when it comes to academic success?
One of the things that we can do that will help students who come from disadvantaged backgrounds and students from all backgrounds is to improve literacy in our state. Our literacy rates are less than desirable. We've got a lot of work to do. And when kids learn to read, they can read to learn anything. And so, I'm really encouraged by the governor's overtures about making deeper investments in early education. The achievement gap starts even before kids get to kindergarten. That means that, as we've heard from the experts, as soon as kids are born, we have to talk, read, and sing to them. And now they're even saying talk, read, sing, and count, so that we introduce introduce our kids to math in fun ways and math facts that help to prepare them for math literacy going forward. And so I intend to help our state organize a statewide campaign to improve literacy with an emphasis on early students, but also intervention programs for our older students who are struggling to read. I've worked with some programs like the Freedom School, which literally helped kids improve their reading by a whole grade level in as little as 6 weeks. And so we've got to invest in these programs. And, you know, this will help us to close the achievement gap. We need to provide great training for our educators. And in some cases, we have to have strong programs to help our students overcome socioeconomic challenges. We have a high number of students in our schools who are homeless. They come to school hungry, and many have experienced trauma. And so I'll be working on programs to provide more school-based counselors and resources to support our special education teachers and staff so that they can support our students in the state. And if we do more around expanding science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, or STEAM, as we call it, we can help students from all backgrounds. I've read research that shows that STEAM programs help kids regardless of their income background. And let's face it, there's going to be 1.5 million jobs in technology in just a few years, and we may only have half the applicants for those jobs. It's in our best interest to prepare the workforce of tomorrow and to help close the achievement gap by making sure that kids get access to computer science and computers that work and the ability to learn the technology that they'll use in the jobs of tomorrow.
You just won a very tight race against a fellow Democrat, Marshall Tuck. In fact, that race broke a record for the most expensive superintendent race ever in U.S. history. And congratulations, by the way. As Cal Matters put it in a recent article, the superintendent of public instruction is mostly a bully pulpit in the state with a largely administrative function and little rulemaking authority. If that's the case, why is so much money spent on getting one person or the other into this position?
Well, I'll tell you this, the $40 million that my opponents and his supporters spent against me, I wish had been directed towards helping our students. That would have been a great start towards addressing some of the education challenges that we have in this state. And I would say this, while the position as state superintendent, you know, I always say we don't have direct responsibility or control over what the 1,000 school districts in the state does, but we get all the blame, and I accept that. But I do believe it's a very important microphone for and spokesperson for addressing the needs of education in our state. And because I've served as a state legislator, I feel very capable to attend to one of the key functions of this job, working closely with the governor and the state legislature to get the resources to our schools that our teachers and our educators need to support our students. And so I think that the position is quite influential and can be influential for improving public education. There are some who want to see public education fail. And I think that many of those who supported me in this campaign really view themselves as the ultimate defenders of public education and wanting to make sure that there's no competition in education, but that every student will get a quality education regardless of his or her zip code or background. That's the promise that we make to students in this country, and I intend to be one of the gatekeepers of preserving that promise for our California students.
Your opponent was backed primarily by charter school supporters, and you were backed by the teachers union. As the victor in that race, what role do you see charter schools having here in California?
Well, you know, charters have played a role, and there are many, you know, charter schools are supposed to be learning labs of innovation, and some charter schools have been that. We have seen charter schools that have, provided ways to serve students who have not been as well served in other traditional schools, like African-American students and Native American students who are served on a reservation. Charter schools have also provided strong arts programs and other programs that some districts have not been able to provide, like dual language immersion programs. Having said that, I think that we have to really have a balanced conversation as it relates to charters. And I've talked about that perhaps now is a time to take a pause on the growth of any new charter schools. And I will work hard to support all the students in all of our schools right now, in our charter public schools and our traditional public schools. But right now, we've got to tackle the issue of resources. And every time you open a new school without providing resources, you're also taking away resources from another school that's working to get better. And I think that's the conversation that we have to have. Charter school law has not been revisited for a couple of decades. California has a very ambitious charter environment and movement. And I think we've got to take some time to figure out what's going to be best for California education overall. Any day now, we're going to get a report from the Charter School Task Force that the previous superintendent, Tom Torlakson, convened. And I'm hopeful that that will have some insights that point to where the conversation should go as it relates to charter schools. I've made it known that I am opposed to any for-profit charter schools, and I co-authored legislation that the governor signed last year that bans for-profit charter schools. I don't think we should ever allow profit to be above the quality education of our kids. And so we may have to have some tough conversations, but I believe if we bring everyone to the table, we can have the right conversation about what's the role of charter schools, what's the right balance as it relates to charter schools, and how do we overall strengthen public education in our state.
On the other side of that coin, are there issues backed by the teachers' unions that you disagree with?
Well, I'm glad to have support from teachers and educators. I spend a lot of time in classrooms listening to teachers' concerns about how we help our kids. And I'm honored to have had their support. But as teachers know, I don't always, I'm going to always vote independently and support, things in an independent way. And as a legislator, I supported policies that the teachers' unions did not agree with, like having a later start time in school for middle school students and high school students. The reason I supported that is that there is tremendous research that shows that a later start time benefits our students who are older, that they need more rest for better brain development and for even promoting school safety. And it was hard to really argue with that research. And so I'm going to always do what I've tried to do for the last 12 years of my life in politics and being in an elected position. And that's, vote in a way that would make my kids proud. And if it's not an issue that's good for kids, then I can't support it, no matter who's supporting me. I may not always make the right decision, but I haven't had a sleepless night in politics because I always look through the lens of what's best for our kids, and I'll continue to do that as state superintendent.
And any final thoughts on the budget?
We're looking forward to what comes out today. Again, I'm excited to be working closely with the governor, who really has a track record from his days back as mayor of investing in programs like early education. He and I have worked together on some mentoring programs, and so I am encouraged that this budget will be strong as it relates to, supporting early education and other needs. Now, I'm sure there will be things that aren't in it that we'd like to see. And so we get the next several months to work on strengthening that budget and getting it right, by the mid-year budget revise, which will come out in May. And so I look forward to working with our governor and our legislature on providing the best budget we can for our state and for our students in California.
California Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond discussing the future of education in the state. Thank you so much for being on Insight this morning.
Thank you, and thank you to your listeners for taking part in our conversation.
And, of course, we'll have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyek. Prodigy is a big word to throw around, but in the case of our next guest, there may be no better description. Amarin Olmeda is 10 years old, and she will be the guest soloist at the Auburn Symphony on January 20th. An aspiring violinist, the girl has been playing since the age of four. She made her first performance debut at the ripe old age of six, if you can believe it. Since then, Amarin has been a soloist with several local symphonies and has won several competitions. Amarin Olmeda, thank you so much for being here on Insight.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's terrific to have you sitting across the table. Also joining us today is Maestro Peter Jaffe. He's conductor of both the Auburn and Stockton Symphonies, correct?
Correct. And actually, even the Folsom Lake Symphony, too. But we're here to talk about the Auburn Symphony.
Right. So we'll just toss those all in and focus on Auburn. Welcome to Insight as well. You've been here on several occasions.
Well, thank you so much. And it's really a pleasure and an honor to be talking about somebody who is the real deal. I mean, Amarin Olmeda truly is a prodigy. She really is a young genius. She's one in a million.
Amarin, what do you think when you hear something like that? When you hear
now, don't get a big head. You didn't hear any of that.
I feel really happy. It just makes me like feel like really comfortable to know that people are there for me and helping me, you know, become really good.
What an unselfish attitude.
I love
Isn't
it.
That great?
Yeah. And I'm so curious when you knew or when your parents knew or the people around you started to spot the fact that you had this ability, this gift.
Normally when I started doing competitions, I kept winning them and then people started asking me to play with their orchestras. I felt like that was when I could do really well.
You're like, this is happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I assume most people that have these abilities really love what they do.
Yes.
You love it?
Yes, I love it.
I assume you must spend an awful lot of time practicing it, so I hope you do love it.
Yes.
She really does love it. And, of course, you know, you folks out there listening, you can't see, but Amarin is the embodiment of a smile.
Yeah.
I mean, when she plays, it's just pure joy. It's really
Thank
inspiring.
You.
I think we have to make a little correction because I heard actually that you started playing when you were 3 and a half.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
So it's even earlier than four.
Wow. And how did that happen? Like who says, let's put a violin into the hands of a 3 and a half year old? And yeah. Do they make them that small?
Yes, they make them that small. My older brother, Peter, he started before me, and he didn't like it. So my parents let him quit, and then I just loved it ever since.
Uh-huh. What does Peter think now?
He plays the cello, and he
He's okay?
He likes it. He likes the cello.
Is there a fun family competition between the two of you?
Not really.
No. Yeah, there's no competition, apparently. Well, I think it's really exciting. What are you doing to prepare for this big event on January 20th, where you will be the featured soloist?
Yeah,
she's playing the Bruch Violin Concerto.
Thank you for pronouncing that for me.
Yeah, and just so everybody knows, the program begins with the Wagner Prelude to the Third Act of Lohengrin, which is a really zippy curtain raiser, and it ends with a milestone of the 20th century, the Prokofiev Fifth Symphony.
In fact, Peter, I'm glad you mentioned that. We're going to play a quick clip here that so people can hear what she will be playing. This is not the one featuring you, but this is what people will hear. Peter, can you expound a little bit on that? What are the difficulties of that piece?
As you can hear, you know, this is a completely adult piece. I mean, this is a piece that is traditional in the repertoire. It requires the highest amount of virtuosity from the soloist. And Amarin is up to that task. And when I said at the beginning of this that she's the real deal, I just want to give that a little perspective. I had the amazing honor of being on the conducting staff at the Aspen Music Festival for 14 years and getting to work with a lot of the prodigies and geniuses that now have major careers, people like Gil Shaham, Sarah Chang, Kyoko Takazawa. And I worked with them when they were at a very young age also. Amarin is absolutely in that class.
Wow.
And she will, if she continues the right type of work and progress, and she's already amazing, if she keeps going down that golden path, which she's headed for, we are all going to be able to say we knew her when.
When, yeah. I interviewed her in 2019, is what I'll be saying.
Yeah, I mean, even to put this brief career in perspective, because now she's all of 10 years old, right? We first heard her 2 years ago when she won the Young Artist Competition with the Auburn Symphony.
Okay.
And just last year, at the tender age of 9, she played the Saint-Saëns Introduction and Rondo Capriccioso with the orchestra, and people had tears of joy listening to her play. I mean, you're not listening to this, Amarin, right? We don't want you to get a big head. But she really is one of those very special talents.
When you see people tear up, Amarin, based on the music that's coming out of you, that you're playing, how does that make you feel? What do you think?
It makes me feel very happy that I made people happy with my music. And I just want to keep doing that and just make people be filled with joy and happiness.
The piece that we heard, technically, what are the parts in there that make you nervous? You know, why is it difficult? What makes that a difficult piece?
Well, every piece is difficult. You have to make it very good to be able to play it well. But honestly, I don't get nervous. There's no reason to get nervous when you play a piece. You're just
probably
up there.
Why you're a prodigy.
Thank you. Yes, you're just there to make people happy, and you don't need to be nervous.
I'd like to dispel a myth about child prodigies, because often people will hear and see a talent like Amarin and say, well, she's only 10 years old and she's got amazing fingers and it's all technique, but she doesn't really actually have the right mature feelings. That's totally wrong. It's the myth. And actually, if you think about it, any of us, when we remember when we were 10 years old or an early teenager, we feel things more intensely, actually, than we do as adults.
Right. So when you said they don't have the right mature feelings to play that piece, you mean they don't have in their...
That's the myth.
That's the myth. Okay.
That's the myth, that they're not emotionally equipped to be able to play this adult music, when actually they can. One of my favorite stories ever is coming off of an Aspen performance with one of the prodigies just like Amarin, and somebody came up to me backstage and said, you know, she shouldn't even be allowed to have feelings like that at this age. You know, but they do. She does. You know, she has those very intense mature feelings when she plays. And that's what makes her really special, in addition to the amazing technique.
Wow. We are speaking right now with, that's who you just heard, Maestro Peter Jaffe, conductor of the Auburn Symphony, where 10-year-old Amarin Olmeda will be performing as the guest soloist on January 20th. Just before we started Insight this morning, Amarin, you got here a little bit early and played a piece for us, and I'd like to play that now if we can. And then when we come out of it, you can tell us what it is and why it's important to you. Thank you. So, Amarin, when you hear a piece like that being played back after you just played it not that long ago, what are you listening for? Are you hearing imperfections or, I could have done this, I could have done that? Or do you just allow yourself to be absorbed as though it wasn't even a piece of work that you did?
It's always good to fix your mistakes and you learn from your mistakes as well. But normally, I just let it go as it is. It's just a really nice piece, and I just love to play it.
You should tell everybody what it was.
It was the Gigue from the Partita No. 3 by Bach. It's a dance.
Is it one of your favorites?
Yes.
Uh-huh. It sort of highlights your talents.
Yes.
And everybody should know, I mean, she recorded that live in the studio right before the interview, one take. In other words, she didn't stop, fix something, edit, and whatever. That was just one continuous take.
It literally was right before we started Insight,
yeah.
Like minutes before.
Yeah.
Really impressive.
Thank
and it
you.
Just sounded fantastic. Okay, so I want to know a little bit more about Amarin. So we talked about how you have to practice a lot. How does school work for you since so much of your day is taken up with the music?
Normally, my day is we wake up in the morning and we have this thing called morning time with my family. It's where we read stories and we sing songs, folk songs, and then we read poetry. And then I'll practice about 2 hours, and then I'll do schoolwork for 2 hours. Then I'll have recess and lunch, and then normally I'll finish my schoolwork and then finish my practice, and then we'll go out to extracurriculars.
And what are some of the extracurriculars or your favorites?
I do ballet, and I also do art lessons. I love art.
Uh-huh. Is that all? You also like to collect American Girl dolls, right?
Yes.
Do you have a favorite?
No, not really. I have a lot.
Uh-huh.
I like them a lot.
Do I understand that you knit and sew as well?
Yes, I do a lot of things with my family. I knit and I sew and I do ballet. I also like to do watercolor art and go outside with my family and work on our farm.
Oh, farm. So
yes.
There's some gardening involved as well?
Yes. We have animals, too.
There's very little that she doesn't do.
Peter, you stole the words out of my mouth. Seriously, I'm looking across at you. It's just hard to believe. You're so well-balanced and just articulate.
Thank you.
Across the board. It's so impressive and terrific to have you here. And I look forward to this event on January the 20th. What do you have coming up later in the year? Anything?
I'm going to be playing with the Solano Symphony and also with the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra. So those are going to be really exciting.
Peter, when putting a show like this together on the 20th, is there anything specific that you need to take into account when you have a soloist that's just 10?
Well, that's the cool thing. No.
It's just
you see?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole reason for putting this amazing genius up there is that she can work with the symphony the way you would have any adult soloist do it. I mean, that's the whole reason for putting somebody up there to say, look how amazing this is. When we worked together last year, it would often be the case with somebody less talented than Amarin that you would always have to sort of start from the beginning of the piece because they can't sort of process in your mind if you stop and you want to do something else and start right in the middle. But Amarin is right there. You can stop right in the middle of a phrase, do a little patch-up fix or make something enhanced in the orchestra and come back, and she'll know that you're going to start right there instead of thinking you have to start from A to get to B. And so no. I feel like when I work with Amarin, it's just like working with any internationally acclaimed soloist.
Which she's on her way to becoming, right?
I hope so.
Yeah.
We hope so too, Amarin. So nice to have you here. And I hope so that you just heard is 10-year-old violinist Amarin Olmeda. I'm saying your name correctly, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. And maestro Peter Jaffe talking about Amarin's upcoming solo performance with the Auburn Symphony. That's on January 20th. Thank you so much for being here this morning and getting out of your daily routine.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks to both of you. And what about the Mondavi Center? Oh, it's at the Mondavi Center. Okay. At the Mondavi Center. I didn't realize that. So
yes.
At the Mondavi Center.
It's a Sunday matinee.
Oh, it's a Sunday matinee. Even better.
Yeah.
So we'll have more on our website, all those details at capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to your NPR station, Cap Radio. You are listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak. And our previous segment focused on a childhood musical prodigy. And now we bring in Cap Radio arts reporter Jeff Hudson. Jeff, did you get a chance to hear that?
It's wonderful. I'm delighted to meet her, too.
Yeah. So Jeff's got the scoop on some of the premier upcoming classical music concerts in Northern California and Nevada in January and February. And 10-year-old Amarin Olmeda somewhat set the tone for your focus today, which is talented young artists, right?
Right. And so let's just get right to business here. Unghee Cho, who grew up in Davis and is now doing a doctorate in cello performance at the New England Conservatory, returns to town at Christmas time and also in the summer. And he does these concerts that he calls the Mellon Music Festival, M-E-L-L-O-N. And that's from Lord of the Rings. Mellon means friend if you're into Tolkien.
Right.
So on Friday night, he's performing a concert with jazz programming and watermelon music in Davis, and then on Saturday night at Sudwerk Brewing Company, different music both nights. But Unghee is a really, really talented cellist. He's been on Insight a couple of times. They're going to be playing a piece by Paul Schoenfeld on the program called Cafe Music, and I found a commercial recording of that. So let's hear a little bit of Paul Schoenfeld's Cafe Music. And that's a little sample of Paul Schoenfeld's Cafe Music. Also on the program is going to be a Mendelssohn piece and a piece by Claude Bowling, a suite for jazz flute and other instruments. So interesting concert. That's the Friday night program. There will be some improv stuff on the Saturday night program.
So the Saturday night one is the one at the brewery.
You're correct.
Yeah.
And so very promising stuff. And if you haven't heard Unghee, he's been an Insight guest a couple of times now. And, really bright guy in his 20s on his way to a very good career. Another young performer will be in town this weekend as well. This is Xue Zhai. I'm hoping that I said it right. He gave me a pronouncer. My Chinese pronunciation leaves a bit to be desired. He is coming to town as a pianist. But
and to town is Sacramento, right? Because we were in Davis prior.
The Chamber Music Society of Sacramento, they do the Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. at Congregation Bet Haverim in Davis. And then the Sunday concert is at Capistrano Hall at Sac State.
Oh, Sac State. Uh-huh.
So now Xue grew up in Davis. He sang bass with the Davis High Madrigals. He went off and got a degree in economics and music, double major at Stanford, worked as an investment banker in Hong Kong for 3 years, decided that what he really wanted to do was be an architect. So he went to Yale, got a master's degree in architecture at Yale, interned with Frank Gehry, the guy who designed Disney Hall in L.A.
Right.
And Frank Gehry liked him well enough that he hired him after the internship was done. So Xue now lives in L.A. He sings bass professionally with the Los Angeles Master Chorale, which is a very nice group. He plays piano professionally with a variety of organizations. And then his day job is working in an architecture firm under Frank Gehry. Pretty nice life.
We're lucky that we have a little time to share with him.
Yeah. When he's in Davis and in Sacramento this week, he will be playing the Mendelssohn piano trio. And so let's hear just a little bit of that. This is from a commercial recording. And as you can hear, that is a piece that presents some challenges to the keyboard performer there. There's a lot of notes that you got to play and play them fast. So this will be quite good. In addition to the Mendelssohn piece, the other music on the program this weekend, there's a piece by Beethoven, another piece by Handel, as arranged by a Scandinavian composer named Halvorsen, and then a piece by Pablo de Sarasate. So that's the Chamber Music Society Saturday night in Davis and Friday afternoon at Sac State.
All right, let's head over the hill to Reno.
Right. And Reno, the Reno Philharmonic conductor Laura Jackson is in her 10th season now, which is she's been there a good long run and still doing quite well. And she also appears as a guest conductor all around the country. The program for this weekend, it's upcoming. It's January 12th at 7:30 p.m. and January 13th at 4 p.m. at the Pioneer Center, both of these concerts in Reno. And they're going to have as the soloists a group called Time for Three, which is a jazz trio. They're going to be playing a piece by Chris Brubeck, who his name comes up from time to time in these quarters.
Yeah.
And so it's a piece called Travel Through Time with Three or something like that, that he composed specifically for Time for Three. It, also on the orchestra part of the program, and you know, the piece that is the orchestral showpiece is Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances, which was composed in 1940. It was Rachmaninoff's last big orchestral piece. So I tracked down a commercial recording just to give you an idea of what the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances can sound like. And that's always been one of my favorite Rachmaninoff pieces for reasons I think you can understand. Then the Stockton Symphony. We just had Peter Jaffe on talking about the Auburn Symphony, but he is also the longtime conductor of the Stockton Symphony.
He does. He didn't want to get too much into that, but he is a part of it.
Well, here we go. January the 26th at Atherton Auditorium, San Joaquin Delta College in Stockton. They're going to have a violinist named Sandy Cameron, who is actually playing this week at SF Jazz as an electric violinist in trumpeter Chris Boddy's band. But when she's done with that, she's going to go over to Stockton and do a orthodox Beethoven violin concerto. You know, when she's playing jazz, she kind of dances around the stage and is really kind of sultry.
Uh-huh.
I am told that she does the Beethoven in a more orthodox manner. And then they're also – Stockton will also be playing Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet selections from the first two suites with actors from UOP doing two-minute scenes from the play interspersed among the music. So let's hear just a little bit of the Prokofiev score.
I see here that sometimes she plays Led Zeppelin's Kashmir.
She does. She did that at SF Jazz two, three years ago. There's also a cello version of that that Maya Beiser plays.
Anyway. I got to catch that at some point because I've seen similar versions and I love it.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Jeff Hudson about some of the region's upcoming classical concerts through February. And we should let you know that all the events Jeff is highlighting this morning are included in Cap Radio's curated guides to live concerts in our region. We have one guide for classical events and another for jazz. They include dates, descriptions, links. You find them all at capradio.org/music. Jeff, we have more, though.
Modesto Symphony Orchestra has concerts coming up on February 1 and 2 at 8 p.m., and they're going to be featuring four young conservatory-trained professional musicians who started out as members of the Modesto Symphony Youth Orchestra. Matthew Ennis is going to be playing the first movement of the Mozart Clarinet Concerto on alto sax. A violinist named Andrew Grishaw will be playing a piece by Modesto's conductor David Lockington. Jonathan Altman, a violinist, will be doing a movement from the Mozart Violin Concerto. And then there's a young composer from Modesto named Andrew Norman, who's done a piece they're going to perform called Sabina. The concert will also feature harpist Madeline Olson, who was born in Tracy in 1995. She's now a graduate student studying harp performance at Juilliard. She'll be playing a piece by Claude Debussy. I couldn't find a recording of that, but here is Madeline playing a Saint-Saëns harp piece, you know, same general era. And lastly, the Sacramento Philharmonic has a Beethoven festival coming up. There are concerts on January the 19th and the 26th, 8 p.m. at the Sacramento Community Center Theater. Guest conductor Jeffrey Kahane, who was the music director of the L.A. Chamber Orchestra for 20 years, and he still works with them periodically as the conductor laureate, will be doing the honors on the podium. Let's hear a little bit of Jeffrey Kahane playing the Beethoven Archduke Trio. This is not a piece that's on the program, but it does give you an idea of how he performs as a pianist, and he is doing a Beethoven concerto.
Oh, right. Okay. Jeff Hudson giving us a rundown of some classical and jazz music you can catch around the area. That is Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Insight produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team, Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. We got help today from Jen Picard, Evan Massler, and Matt Pacini. Today's engineer work, Anthony Van Hook. Our managing editor is Linnea Edmeyer. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. And we are back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks, as always, for joining us.